You're listening to a program from the Aloud Archives. Aloud is a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the LA Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Today's speaker, the poet and novelist Sherman Alexie. By way of introduction, I'd like to reflect on a character who I encountered in Reservation Blues, the principal character Thomas Builds the Fire, of whom Sherman Alexie writes, "He'd caught some disease in the womb that forced him to tell stories. The weight of those stories bowed his legs and bent his spine a bit." The reference is both literal and ironic, which is a characteristic of much of Mr. Alexie's writing, but it is also certainly true that Sherman Alexie himself is one of those writers whose work is so compelling precisely because he himself is compelled to write. There's a passion in his writing that drives him. It's something both visceral and heartfelt, and it is splashed across the page of every word he writes. Sherman Alexie's words first boiled up out of the poetry press only a few years ago and quickly found its way into a broader American consciousness. And today, at the age of only 30, he has already been recognized as one of America's most accomplished and distinctive and important writers, poets, and novelists. He was born into the Spokane and Coeur d'Alene tribes and was raised on the Spokane Indian Reservation, where he underwent brain surgery at the tender age of 6 months and endured a childhood that was beset with health problems. Like so many other writers, especially writers who had health problems in childhood, he turned to reading as a way of escaping the harsher realities of his childhood, and he was set afire by what he read. Mr. Alexie has recalled to an interviewer, for example, the impression that was made on him by that very stirring scene at the end of Grapes of Wrath, where a starving man is suckled by a woman who has lost her baby. And the way he recalls it is that he said to himself, "Aha, so that's the way a story should end," which is a lesson that many writers have not learned, and perhaps we wish they ought to have learned. He went on to excel in school. He attended a high school where the student body was 99% Anglo, and yet he was distinguished and distinguished himself as a class president, an honor student, captain of a basketball team. As you'll soon see, his early health problems were certainly overcome, and he's a strapping, healthy 6'2" basketball player today. Mr. Alexie studied at Gonzaga University in Spokane and Washington State University in Pullman. Today, he and his wife, Diane, a woman of the Hidatsa, Ho-Chunk, and Potawatomi tribes, live in Seattle and are expecting their first child. Mr. Alexie started as a poet, but he is best known today, of course, for his fiction, which is at the same time lyrical and pyrotechnic, and which has today reached a vastly larger and equally enthusiastic audience. His first novel, Reservation Blues, was a work of magic realism in the rock and roll mode. His latest novel, Indian Killer, is a thriller that plays on the deep and sometimes dangerous interplay of race and violence in American history and identity. As dark as the inside of a kidnapper's trunk is how the Village Voice described it, a bloodletting in the name of truth. Between these two polarities is a rich body of work, especially rich for such a young man, including his distinguished book of short stories, The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fist Fight in Heaven, and several volumes of poetry, including his most recent collection, which I'm able to actually fold up for you, The Summer of Black Widows. And it includes his performance as part of the Honor the Earth musical tour and the CD that accompanies it. Sherman Alexie has won rave reviews, by the way, for his performances as a storyteller and, we might say, as a story singer. He faced off the demon of alcoholism, an important theme in his writing, after what he described as a six-year binge that started on the day he entered college. And he has been clean and sober for as many years. Today, he told Publishers Weekly, I get high off public readings. Significantly enough, Sherman Alexie gave up drinking on the very day that his first book was published, The Business of Fancy Dancing, a collection of poetry and short stories from Hanging Loose Press that became the equivalent of a runaway bestseller in the poetry and literary publishing field. And it earned the first of many critical acclaim that he has today enjoyed. The New York Times called him, on the strength of his first book, perhaps the most commanding voice among new American writers. At the heart of Sherman Alexie's work, and it is a passionate and sometimes angry heart that beats in every book, are the perspective, and one might even say the moral imperative, that he brings to his writing. As Mr. Alexie once told an interviewer, there are plenty of Indian writers out there doing this four directions, corn pollen, eagle feather crap. What we're dealing with on our reservation is uranium pollution, alcoholism, suicide. We're worried about a job, about eating, about political corruption, just like everybody else. We don't have time to sit around and rub a crystal. Mr. Alexie has been honored by the American Book Award, acclaimed as one of America's most important young novelists by Granta, and he has been afforded a markedly warm welcome by the critics, whom I can attest from personal experience are a cranky and hard to please lot. Characteristically, he looks on his literary success from a slightly different perspective. The fortunate thing for me, he told one interviewer, is that I am rising out of the ghettoization of my work. The critics themselves have displayed an unreserved enthusiasm for Mr. Alexie and his work. Wildly talented is how people put it. A reviewer for The Nation wrote, on the big Indian reservation that we call the United States, Sherman Alexie is one of the best writers we have. The talent is real, wrote Frederick Bush in the New York Times Book Review, and it is very large, and I will gratefully read whatever he writes in whatever form. To which I say, I second that emotion. Mr. Alexie.
Oh, golly, that was a nice introduction. Wanted to give him a hug. Made me a little shy. I haven't done this in a little while, so I'm a little bit nervous. I'm always nervous in LA, though, the earthquake thing. I grew up in Eastern Washington on the big Columbia Plateau. That doesn't shake. And, you know, my family's lived there for thousands of years. We don't have earthquakes, you know, other than New Year's Eve parties. But, yeah, I'm Sherman Alexie. I'm Spokane Coeur d'Alene. I'm the Indian du jour of the literary world. But it's been a very long day, actually. I keep expecting it to be over, but it doesn't. I haven't gotten any rest. And I've been traveling around for a few years now doing this. And I grew up on a reservation in Eastern Washington State where there were a lot of crimson-necked Americans in the area. And I mean, that is the politically correct term, that or the pigment challenged, I like also. But and, you know, they had a lot of strange ideas about Indians, all these misconceptions, these stereotypes, these outright lies and illusions. And I thought when I started traveling with my books, I'd meet a lot of people who knew a lot about Indians, but I found out that wasn't always the case. I gave a poetry reading at this very prestigious university back east. I won't tell you its name, Harvard, and I read a poem from my first book, The Business of Fancy Dancing. The poem was called House Fires, and in this poem, the father character gets drunk at a New Year's Eve party, the earthquake, very angry, takes the living room furniture out on the front lawn and burns it. Now, I guess the same event occurs in this 19th century Russian play I'd never heard of. But after the reading, this professor at this university, I won't tell you its name, Harvard, came up to me and said, "How were you influenced by this play?" And I said, "Well, I've never heard of the play. I've never heard of the playwright. I'm not an expert in Russian literature." I guess he thought it was because of my last name, you know, Alexei. And and I said, "I don't know. I haven't heard of him." He goes, "No, you must have heard of him. It's the same thing, the same scene. The father character gets drunk, takes furniture in front of the home and burns it. You must have been influenced by this. You must have." And I say, "No, I haven't even heard of the, you know, the writer. I mean, it was a name something like consonant, 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 Nev." And I said, "No, I don't know. I don't know. And he goes, "You must have." And I'm, "No, you must have. No, you must have. No, you must have. No." And finally, very frustrated, he says, "Well, then tell me, what were you influenced by?" And I said, "Well, you see, there was a New Year's Eve party at my house. My father got very angry. My father took our living room furniture out on our front lawn, and my father burned it." And then he gave me that professor stare, you know, which is sort of a combination of an archaeologist and an undertaker, and said, "Oh, did your father read that novel?" And I said, "No, he likes Louis L'Amour." You know, but it's amazing, all these misconceptions about being Indian, you know. Jonathan alluded to it earlier, too, about all this, you know, four directions, corn pollen, eagle feather, Mother Earth, Father Sky. You know, we don't talk like that. We never have, you know. I never heard Indians talk like that until they were making money off white people. That's the very first time I've ever, that's still the only time I hear what Indians talking like that is, you know, because frankly, you'll believe anything we say. Because you don't know any better. I could get up here and say any damn thing I wanted to about my spiritual life and you'd believe me. In fact, that's what we do. We make it up. All these spiritual leaders you think are Indian spiritual leaders, they're making it up. I mean, they could care less about your spiritual life. They just want to make some money, you know. But somehow or another, we have been the enemies of this country for so long, and all of a sudden, now we're the saviors. It's an interesting dilemma for us, you know. You tried to kill us for so long, and now you want us to save you. It's pretty ironic, you know. But you know, this whole fascination with our spiritual, like the men's movement, the white guy men's movement, you know. Well, first of all, you know, when they choose, you know, they go out and choose their spirit. Well, they're running around naked on the weekends pounding drums and stuff. And, you know, Indian guys gave that up a long time ago. I mean, Indian guys are at home on the weekends with the remote control watching television, you know, like we should be. But, I mean, you get these white guys at their weekend gatherings, you know. Are there any men's movement guys here? But, you get these guys at their weekend gatherings, you know, and they're like, when they choose spirit animals, they always choose the largest animal possible, the largest carnivorous animal possible. They always choose bear, wolf, eagle, you know. I mean, they don't realize your spirit animal can be a parakeet or a squirrel or something. I mean, your spirit animal chooses you. You don't choose it. But you get these guys at their meetings, you know, and they're like, "Hello. My name is John. And my spirit animal is a Tyrannosaurus Rex." And then you have to explain, "But John, those things are all dead." You got these white guys going to Jurassic Park for spiritual guidance, you know. But there's a fundamental weakness in that, though, because, I mean, have you seen the leaders of the men's movement? Yeah. Let's take, for instance, a hypothetical person such as Robert Bly. And have you seen Robert Bly? Robert Bly is about this tall. He's about this wide. And I don't want to be lookist here, but he's not exactly Tom Cruise. Now, I'm wondering, do you white men really want this as your model of masculinity? I mean, the warrior within. Well, maybe in Tolkien's world, but not in this world. And it's not that I'm against anybody's true spiritual quests. You know, God, I hope we all are looking for God in one manner or another, but we're all given certain ways to look for God, you know. And this, I mean, the European Americans in this country have given up on Christianity in a major way. And you shouldn't have. Christianity's beautiful. Jesus is cool. Jesus was a socialist. I mean, let's look at the evidence. He believed in food stamps and welfare. And what do you think the fish and bread loaves thing was? I mean, he stuck up for the poor, the disadvantaged, the disabled. I mean, his best friend was a prostitute, Mary Magdalene. And he hung out with 12 guys with great hair wearing great robes who never talked about women. Go read it. Check it out. They didn't. I mean, you know, and you check out Paul and Peter, especially. Look closely. And this was a bunch of white men who went by their full names, so you know. You know, it wasn't John. He was, you know, Jonathan. I kept waiting for the disciple named Trevor. As a friend of mine said, yeah, I didn't know Jesus was Bette Midler. Yeah. And the women who are involved in the New Age movement are really amazing, too. Because, you know, well, they always look the same. They have a uniform. It's interesting when we think of ourselves as being subversive and liberal that we, you know, we shun all that. But they always end up looking the same. They have the long, vaguely uncombed hair, dreamcatcher earrings, turquoise ring on every finger, choker, sundress with matching Birkenstocks. And they come floating onto the reservation, healing every damn thing in their path. And they come looking for a traditional Indian man. And you wouldn't believe how many Indian men suddenly become very, very traditional. You get Indian guys with one tooth named Roscoe becoming shaman. I mean, they're getting out their spam. And you believe us. The point being, I applaud your search for spirituality, but look interior, you know? Look inside yourselves. You're missing out on a lot. I mean, I'm Catholic as well. I'm Indian and Catholic. Double the guilt. But Christianity is beautiful, and you've let it go. I mean, I understand. I mean, the real problem is Christians. I mean, you know? I mean, why do you want to be associated with a religion that includes people like Ralph Reed and you know, Jerry Falwell? But it's also a religion that, you know, has the Berrigan brothers and you know, Henri Nouwen and you know, and these wonderful, progressive, radical, you know, women-friendly, gay-friendly, brown people-friendly, poor people-friendly disciples of Jesus, you know? I mean, because Jesus hung out with brown people. Jesus was brown. The most fascinating thing about that whole argument is, you know, about, you know, I mean, Jesus was either Jewish or probably, you know, very likely he might have been African. And I can't wait. Or I wish I could be there on the day that people like Falwell and Ralph Reed and all these conservative Christians get to the gates of heaven, you know. And they're sitting there waiting. And, you know, and everybody starts, oh, Jesus is coming. Jesus is coming. Jesus is coming. You know, they're in the waiting room. It's a room like this. Jesus is coming. Jesus is coming. The whispers go through the crowd, and everybody's really excited, and Ralph Reed and Jerry Falwell and all these conservative Christians are so excited because Jesus is coming. Jesus is coming. And the chariot starts coming, and they look. And everybody's shouting, "It's Jesus! It's Jesus!" And they're thinking, "Where? I mean, I just see the driver." I wish I could be there for that. Jesus had brown skin, remember that. Oh, so much for that babbling. I'll probably offend any number of you today, but I'm good at that, so. I had a guy named Trevor come up to me once, very angry. And he said, "That's not fair. We're not all named like that." I said, "Well, stereotypes exist because, you know, because they're in some large degree true. Indians are drunks, just not all of us. I'm a former drunk. But, you know, I mean, you know, I'm straight, but, you know, on the scale of straight to gay, I'm somewhere, you know, in the middle, I mean." Now, I write poems. You know, I have a lisp. I use my hands a lot when I talk. And you know, I mean, I'm always looking for Mr. Right, I suppose. But I'll tell you who I really like. Is that Andy Garcia? I mean, I've always been into Latin guys who look like they stink, but stink in a good way. I just could never get into a guy named Trevor. Don't worry, my wife knows about this. And she feels the same way about Andy, actually. It was in our wedding vows. It was, you know, promised love, honor, and cherish until Andy Garcia do we part. Andy Garcia clause. So I'll read this essay, okay? Keep waiting for Robert Bly to get mad at me, too. This is called The Unauthorized Autobiography of Me. Late summer night on the Spokane Indian Reservation, 10 Indians are playing basketball on a court barely illuminated by the streetlight above them. They will play until the brown leather ball is invisible in the dark. They will play until an errant pass jams a finger, knocks a pair of glasses off the face, smashes a nose, and draws blood. They will play until the ball bounces off the court and disappears into the shadows. Sometimes I think this is all you need to know about Native American literature. I have never met a Native American. I have met thousands of Indians. At a Pen American panel in Manhattan in November 1994 on Indian literature, N. Scott Momaday, James Welch, Glory Miguel, Joy Harjo, and myself were on the panel. 200 or 300 people in the audience, mostly non-Indians, 3 or 4 Indians. Questions and answers. "Why do you insist on calling yourselves Indian?" asked a white woman in a nice hat. "It's so demeaning." "Listen," I said. "The word belongs to us now. We are Indians. That has nothing to do with Indians from India. We are not American Indians. We are Indians. Pronounce it right. Indians. It belongs to us. We own it, and we're not going to give it back. So much has been taken from us that we hold on to the smallest things with all of our strength." Winter on the Spokane Indian Reservation, 1976. My two cousins, S and G, have enough money for gloves. They buy them at Irene's grocery store. Irene is a white woman who has lived in our reservation since the beginning of time. I have no money for gloves. My hands are bare. We build snow fortresses on the football field, and since we are Indian boys playing, there must be a war. We stockpile snowballs. S and G build their fortress on the 50-yard line. I build mine on the 30-yard line. We begin our little war. My hands are bare. My cousins are good warriors. They throw snowballs with precision. I am bombarded, under siege, and defeated quickly. My cousins bury me in the snow. My grave is shallow. If my cousins knew how to dance, they might have danced on my grave. But they know how to laugh, so they laugh. They are my cousins, meaning we are related in the Indian way. My father drank beers with their father for most of 2 decades, and that makes us relatives. Indians gather relatives like firewood, protection against the cold. I am buried in the snow, cold, without protection. My hands are bare. After a short celebration, my cousins exhume me. I am too cold to fight. Shivering, I walk for home, anxious for warmth. I know my mother is home. She is probably sewing a quilt. She is always sewing quilts. If she sells a quilt, we have dinner. If she fails to sell a quilt, we go hungry. My mother has never failed to sell a quilt, but the threat of hunger is always there. When I step into the house, my mother is sewing yet another quilt. She is singing a song under her breath. You might assume she is singing a highly traditional Spokane Indian song. She is singing Donna Fargo's The Happiest Girl in the Whole USA. Improbably, this is a traditional Spokane Indian song. The living room is dark in the late afternoon. The house is cold. My mother is wearing her coat and shoes. Why don't you turn up the heat? I ask my mother. No electricity, she says. Power went out, I ask. Didn't pay the bill. I am colder. I inhale, exhale, my breath visible inside the house. I can hear a car sliding on the icy road outside. My mother is making a quilt. This quilt will pay for the electricity. Her fingers are stiff and painful from the cold. She is sewing as fast as she can. The fourth grade music teacher, Mr. Manley, set a row of musical instruments in front of us. From left to right, a flute, clarinet, French horn, trombone, trumpet, tuba, drum. We had our first chance to play that kind of music. Now, the music teacher explained, I want all of you to line up behind the instrument you want to learn how to play. Don, Loretta, and Karen lined up behind the flute. Melissa and Michelle behind the clarinet. Lori and Willette behind the French horn. All 10 Indian boys lined up behind the drum. My sister Mary, she was beautiful. She was 14 years older than me. She wore short skirts and nylons because she was supposed to wear short skirts and nylons back then. It was expected. Her black hair combed long and straight, 1970. Often, she sat in her favorite chair, the fake leather lounger we rescued from the dump. Holding a hand mirror, she combed her hair, applied her thick makeup, much lipstick and eyeshadow, no foundation, and she was always leaving the house. I don't remember where she went, but I do remember sitting at her feet, rubbing my cheek against her nylon calf while she waited for a ride. She died in an early morning fire in Montana in 1981. At the time, I was sleeping at a friend's house in Washington. I was not dreaming of my sister. Sherman, asks the critic, how does your work apply to the oral tradition? Well, I say, as I hold my latest book close to me, it does not apply at all because I type this. And I'm really, really quiet while I'm typing it. Summer 1977, Steve and I want to attend the KISS concert in Spokane. KISS is very popular on my reservation. Gene Simmons, the bass player, Paul Stanley, lead singer, and rhythm guitarist Ace Frehley, lead guitar, Peter Criss, drummer. All four hide their faces behind elaborate makeup. Simmons, the devil, Stanley, the lover, Frehley, the spaceman, Criss, the cat, the songs. Do you love me? Calling Dr. Love, Love Gun, Making Love, Come On and Love Me. Steve and I are too young to go on our own. His uncle and aunt, born again Christians, decide to chaperone us. Inside the Spokane Coliseum, the four of us find seats far from the stage and the enormous speakers. Uncle and aunt wanted to avoid the bulk of the crowd, but have landed us in the unofficial pot-smoking section. We are overwhelmed by the sweet smoke. Steve and I pretend to cover our mouths and noses with styrofoam cups, but we breathe deeply. Kiss opens their show with staged explosions, flashing red lights, a prolonged guitar solo by Freely. Simmons spits fire. The crowd rushes the stage. All the pot smokers in our section hold lighters, tiny flames flickering high above their heads. The songs are so familiar. Steve and I know all the words. Everybody in the Coliseum knows all the words except the uncle and aunt. And the audience sings along. The songs, Let Me Go, Rock and Roll, Detroit Rock City, Rock and Roll All Night. The decibel level is tremendous. Steve and I can feel the sound waves crashing against the styrofoam cups we hold over our faces. Aunt and uncle are panicked, finally assured that the devil plays a mean guitar. This is too much for them. It is too much for Steve and I, but we pretend to be disappointed when aunt and uncle drag us out of the Coliseum. During the drive home, aunt and uncle play Christian music on the radio. They're trying to clean the air. Loudly and badly, they sing along. Steve and I are in back of the Pacer, looking up through the strangely curved rear window. There is a meteor shower, the largest in a decade. Steve and I smell like pot smoke. We smile at this. We would smile anyway. Our ears ring, we make wishes on the shooting stars, though both of us know that a shooting star is not a star. It's just a sliver of stone. I made a very conscious decision to marry an Indian woman who made a very conscious decision to marry me, an Indian man. Our hope? To give birth to and raise Indian children who love themselves. That is the most revolutionary act possible. I am curious about the Indian writers who identify themselves as mixed blood. It must be difficult for them trying to decide into which container they should place their nouns and verbs. Yet it must be good to be invisible, too, as a blonde, Aryan-featured Jew might have known in Germany during World War II. Then again, I think of the horror stories that a pale Jew might have told about their life hiding in plain sight during the Holocaust. An incomplete list of people whom I wish were Indian. Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Johnson, Meryl Streep, Helen Keller, Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, Superman, Adam, Eve, Muhammad Ali, Billie Jean King, John Lennon, Jimmy Carter, Rosa Parks, Shakespeare, John Steinbeck, D.B. Cooper, Voltaire, Harriet Tubman, Flannery O'Connor, Pablo Neruda, Amelia Earhart, Sappho, Mary Magdalene, Robert De Niro, Susan B. Anthony, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wilma Rudolph, Isadora Duncan, Bruce Springsteen, Diane Fossey, Patsy Cline, Jesus Christ. Summer 1995, Seattle, Washington. I'm idling at a red light when a car filled with white boys pulls up beside me. The white boy in the passenger seat leans out his window. I hate you, Indian motherfuckers, he screams. I quietly wait for the green light. 1978, David, Randy, Stevie, and I decide to form a reservation doo-wop group. Like the Temptations with braids. During recess, we practice behind the old tribal school. Steve, a falsetto, is the best singer. I am the worst singer, but have the deepest voice and am therefore an asset. What songs do you want to sing, asks David. Tracks of My Tears, says Steve, who always decides these kind of things. We sing, desperately trying to remember the lyrics to that song. We try to remember other songs. We remember the chorus to most, the first verse of a few, and only one in its entirety. For some unknown reason, we all know the complete lyrics of Monster Mash, a novelty hit from the 50s. However, since I'm the only one who can manage to sing along with the pseudo-Transylvanian accent that Monster Mash requires, this dubious skill makes me the lead singer, despite Steve's protests. We need a name for our group, says Randy. How about the Warriors, I say. Everybody agrees. We watch westerns. We sing Monster Mash over and over. We want to be famous. We want all the little Indian girls to shout our names. Finally, after days of practice, we are ready for our debut. Walking in a row like soldiers, the four of us parade around the playground. We sing Monster Mash. I am in front, followed by Steve, David, then Randy, who was the shortest, but the toughest fighter our reservation has ever known. We sing, we are the warriors. All of the other Indian boys and girls line up behind us as we march. We are heroes. We are loved. I sing with everything I have inside of me, pain, happiness, anger, depression, heart, soul, small intestine. I sing and am rewarded with people who listen. This is why I became a writer. Poetry equals anger times imagination. Have you stood in a crowded room where nobody looks like you? If you are white, have you stood in a room full of black people? Are you an Irish man who has strolled through the streets of Compton? If you are black, have you stood in a room full of white people? Are you an African man who has played the back nine at the local country club? If you are a woman, have you stood in a room full of men? Are you Sandra Day O'Connor or Ruth Ginsburg? Since I left the reservation, almost every room I enter is filled with people who do not look like me, who do not think like me, who do not believe the same things I believe. There are only approximately 2 million Indians in this country. We could all fit into one medium-sized city. We should look into it. Often, though, I am most alone in bookstores where I'm reading from my work. I look up from the page at a sea of white faces. This is frightening. So many people claim to be Indian, speaking of an Indian grandmother, a warrior grandfather. Let's say the United States government announced that every Indian had to return to their reservation tomorrow. How many people would shove their Indian ancestor back into the closet? My mother, she still makes quilts. My wife and I sleep beneath one. My brother works for our tribal casino. One sister works for our bingo hall, while the other works in the tribal finance department. Our adopted little brother, James, who is actually our second cousin, is a freshman at Reardon High School. He can run the mile in 5 minutes. My father is an active alcoholic. He used to leave us for weeks at a time to drink with his friends and cousins, and I'd missed him so much I'd cry myself sick. Every time he left, I ended up in the emergency room. But I always got well, and he always came back. He'd walk in the door without warning, and we'd forgive him. I could always tell when he was going to leave. He would be tense, quiet, unable to concentrate. He'd flip through magazines and television channels. He'd open the refrigerator door, study its contents, shut the door, and walk away. 5 minutes later, he'd be back at the fridge, rearranging items on the shelves. I would follow him from place to place, trying to prevent his escape. Once, he went into the bathroom, which had no windows, while I sat outside the only door and waited for him. I could not hear him inside. I knocked on the thin wood. I was 5 years old. "Are you there?" I asked. "Are you still there?" Years later, I am giving a reading at a bookstore in Spokane, Washington. There is a large crowd. I read a story about an Indian father who leaves his family for good. He moves to a city 1,000 miles away. Then he dies. It is a sad story. When I finish, a white woman in the front row breaks into tears. "What's wrong?" I ask her. "I'm so sorry about your father," she says. "Thank you," I say. "But that's my father sitting right next to you." Thanks. Is that 30 minutes? Thanks. See, now we do the pseudo Oprah thing. Don't I wish?
Thanks very much. That was wonderful.
There's an Indian due up on that Oprah list. There's an Indian due up, but the thing is, it's not going to be me. It's going to be Susan Power or Louise Erdrich. Mark my words, it's either going to be The Grass Dancer or Love Medicine. Now, I'm going to be very happy for Susan and Louise. I'm friends with them, but I'm also going to be very, very pissed. She's putting literary books on the bestseller lists. That's wonderful. I mean, think of at one point, The English Patient, The Book of Ruth, A Song of Solomon, Snow Falling on Cedars were in the top five. You know, that was it. That's, oh my God. Oprah, I love you.
Well, it's certainly true that she has become the most talked about figure in American letters among authors who want to sell books. I've had that conversation myself.
Every author wants to sell books. They say they don't, they're lying.
Of course. I want to start with a question that was ringing in my head as I sat and listened and enjoyed your remarks, and I'll take the liberty of the first question and then I'll look for hands. People who read your books often come away with a sense that you are an angry man. There is a certain edge, sometimes subtle, sometimes not so subtle, in your writing. It's an edge of anger. I have a quote of something you told a Village Voice interviewer apropos of Indian Killer, your most recent book, a book with some very intense and physically violent moments. And you said, people talk about me as this angry young Indian writer. You want anger? I'll give you an idea of what kind of anger is in the Indian community and what kind of anger we're facing from outside of that community. And that was apropos of what we find in Indian Killer. And yet, I couldn't help but feel charmed and beguiled by the personality that we saw moments ago on this stage. And so my question is, are you as angry somewhere in your heart as your prose and your poetry might suggest? Is that what drives you?
Yeah.
And what are you angry about? And what are you angry about?
It's very interesting. I didn't get the anger tag as much earlier in my career until Indian Killer came out. And those of you who, I mean, may or may not have read it, it's a feel-good thriller about interracial murder. And but that's where the tag stuck up. And I mean, I met, quite a few reporters across the country on my book tour who would tell me after they talked with me and had a good time, they'd say, I was afraid to come here. Because I thought you were going to be this, militant, radical Indian guy. And then there was this one reporter for actually the New York Times who first question out of his mouth was, do you have any white friends? And I said, no. I do. Some of my best friends are white, actually. Yeah, I'm angry. God, I mean, how could you not be? But it's not my. It's Gandhi himself said, that anger is a positive emotion when used in positive ways. And I use my anger to create art. I use my anger to challenge and offend and question the status quo in this country. I come from a group of people who were subjected to the most intense, long-lasting, genocidal philosophy in history. Over 500 years now, this country has been trying to eliminate it, and the Indian Wars are not over. They're not. In my state, Washington State, the Republican House, representatives are introducing a bill that would prevent Indian tribes from contributing money to political campaigns. So all of a sudden, we're not even allowed to participate in the democratic process, however corrupt it is. And they're saying because we are sovereign. That's their philosophy. Well, you're sovereign. So all of a sudden, we are foreigners within our own country. And in this bill, part of the bill, one of the writers on the bill is to prevent contributions from foreign people, from other countries, to political campaigns in Washington State. So all of a sudden, we're grouped in with, Japanese businessmen and Russian mafia, I'm mad. I don't see how you couldn't be, and not only in the sense of being Indian, but walking through the streets of any city, and you see, the hundreds of homeless people. We have 72 different kinds of butter in the supermarket, and we can't find a way to feed everybody. And the selfishness in this country is tremendous. Welfare reform. Nobody cares about poor people. If we really did care about you know, poor people and unemployed people, we'd be rallying at the corporations that are sending all the jobs out to other countries where people work for $2 a day to make tennis shoes. And we're not doing that. So yes, I'm angry. But people aren't going to listen to somebody just ranting and raving all the time. You got to put humor into it. And plus, when somebody's laughing, it hurts them more when you punch them.
You know, I want to follow up on one thing. I read in the clips that I gathered in anticipation of coming here today that you were or have been at one time a stand-up comic. I can sort of see why that might have been the case. Is that true? Did you do stand-up comedy?
I'm working that way. I've done a few clubs and things, and I'm auditioning for a big festival to take place next year. So, you know, the great stand-up comedy is some great art. It's great poetry. It's about moments and images. And I just like the idea of reaching different kinds of audiences. I mean, I have a literary audience. I have a mystery murder audience. I have an academic audience. And I would like a stand-up comic audience. I think you can combine all those things. I mean, some people have called me impatient. But there's just many ways to express how you're feeling and thinking, and that's just one way to do it. I didn't mean to be funny. I didn't realize I was until I started talking to people. I mean, everyday conversation I am. Some friends of ours who work for my mailbox at home, a Vietnamese man, came to a reading and thought I was funny, and he asked my wife when she came in, goes, "Sherman's very funny. Is he funny at home too?" Goes, "Yeah." So I didn't mean to. So
I do want to give a chance for questions from the audience. Go ahead. I'm going to repeat your question because we're taping today's event for the archives. Go ahead. Let me just read the question having to do with what assumptions you encountered among publishers when first submitting your work for publication.
Well, I've been very fortunate in my publishing career. I mean, my first book came out in 92, and I have 10 since then. So, and I've gotten a lot of, you know, my reviews have been mostly positive, and so I've been very fortunate in that. But I, when I started out, and still today, I still get a lot of, I got a rejection letter once that said, you know, why is Indian poetry so sad? So, you know, or they don't like what I do because it doesn't fit the expectations, you know. I mean, it's not about... you know, Mother Earth, Father Sky. People want to read Indian spirituality stuff, or it's not a, you know, it's not autobiographical work about my days in the American Indian movement, you know, running around the country, you know, protesting this or protesting that. I tell very ordinary stories about very ordinary people. It's not glamorous whatsoever, and I think people get a little disappointed in that. And in fact, even the people who like my work tend to see more in it. You know, they tend to bring their vision, for lack of a better term, to it in the sense that they start imagining, like Thomas Bilsdefier, who's this misfit storytelling, they start seeing him as this shaman, this healer, this, when he's just sort of this clueless, sort of geeky guy stumbling around the reservation telling stories. And that's all I see him as. But they start assigning all these values to my characters based on stereotypes. In the publishing world, you know, at the beginning, when I started shopping books around, people would say things like, "Oh, this is really good, but we already have our Indian book this season." So there are slots. Don't believe otherwise. There are slots. I mean, there are hundreds of books written about Indians, but very few slots are left aside for Indian writers writing about Indians. And there's, you know, 15 or 20 of us who get those slots. So that happened. But now I'm moving a little beyond that. I mean, they're using me to blurb, you know what the term means, to put comments on the back covers of books. They're using me to, they want my comments on the back covers of white guys' books. So they're using me to sell white guy books, which is quite the compliment, you know. It means I've arrived. So it's getting better, but, you know, I'm an anomaly. I'm an exception. Most brown writers, you know, don't get that kind of luxury. You know, they're marketed to very small niches. I mean, one of the ironic things is one of the weaknesses of being an Indian writer, I don't know if that's the right term, weakness, but one of the
problems is that the India community is so small, we don't have a built-in book audience. And frankly, Indians don't buy books. Sorry in the crowd there, but it's true. So that's one of the problems, but it's also one of our strengths in a sense, is because we have to appeal to a larger audience, and we write in a way that would appeal to a larger audience.
I'm curious, what kind of response do you get from your readers who are Indians?
Everywhere but on my reservation, it's really good. there it's split. I think they get sort of tired of reading these Indian books that don't feel like Indians. I don't want to name names, but most of the Indian characters in books written by Indians don't have much to do with the way we live our daily lives. And I think my books do. I mean, first of all, they're funny. I mean, Indians are the funniest people on the planet. And then you read these books by Indian writers that are so damn serious all the time, you think, oh, come on, somebody would make a joke there. some of the best times I've ever had in my life have been at wakes and funerals. And so that kind of humor and cultural insiderness is really missing in a lot of Indian literature. Because most of the books written by Indians in this country are written from a very small segment of the Indian world, mostly very mixed blood, urban raised, highly educated Indian writers. And they dominate the publishing world. And there are only a couple of us who are reservation raised, and only a few of us who are, I don't want to get into trouble with mixed blood connotations, blood quantum stuff, but very few of us who are, well, let's put it this way, most of the people we think of as being our Indian writers, Farrah Fawcett has more Indian blood than they do.
Wow.
Farrah Fawcett is 1/8 Choctaw. She has more Indian blood than half the people we call Indian writers. Wow.
Now, I'm intrigued by what you said about the response on your own reservation. What kind of response have you gotten there?
Well, it has a lot less to do with the books themselves than, tribal politics. I mean, mm-hmm. The people who didn't like me when I was 7 years old don't like my books. And the people who did like me like my books. So there haven't been a lot of crossover in the years. So, I'll tell you a funny story about my importance on the reservation, at least my work's importance. I play basketball. I need to tell you that. I play basketball. I've had quite a career in the Northwest in Indian basketball. I used to be good. I'm not anymore. But the receptionist at Atlantic Monthly Press, my publisher, came up to me this last fall and said, I don't know if you know this, but my uncle worked forestry on your reservation. Ted, and I worked with Ted one summer. And I go, oh, Ted, yeah, great. Gosh, I haven't seen him in a while. How's he doing? So we did small talk, and she said, yeah. Well, I guess Ted, her uncle Ted, was telling her this story that he was really wondering how people on my reservation were reacting to my books. So he went up to this Indian elder man and said, do you read Sherman's books? And the Indian elder said, I don't read his stuff. He shoots too much. he called me a ball hog.
That's great.
So there's my importance on the reservation. So. Okay.
Let me make sure I'm covering the audience. Do you have any other hand? Any questions from the audience? Okay. I know from reading about you that at least one of the books you read as a young man was Grapes of Wrath. I'm curious who your other influences are as a young writer growing up and learning your craft. Who do you read for pleasure?
Well, I read everything. But the thing is, I wasn't going to be a writer. I didn't know Indians wrote books. Nobody showed me a book written by an Indian until I was 22 years old. So I didn't know that, so that wasn't even in a realm of possibility. I was going to be a doctor, actually. Like most sickly kids who spend a lot of time in hospitals, I fell in love with the whole thing, especially white pantyhose, nurses, I still have a thing for white pantyhose, actually. Mm-hmm. But some people have audiences, some people have therapists. But so I was going to be a pediatrician to help mm-hmm. sick kids, but I couldn't handle human anatomy class in college. Kept fainting. And that's not good bedside manner, I suppose. And But I always loved books. I read like crazy. I read everything. Auto repair manuals, the backs of cereal boxes, you know, newspapers, papers blowing through the wind, everything I could pick up. I loved words. And I was always a really good liar. And you know, able to...
Central skill of the novelist.
Yeah, exactly. I could conjure up these incredibly complex lies instantly, and everybody knew I was lying, but they couldn't unravel it to get, you know, so... I mean, you either, you know, I mean, nothing I hate more than a bad liar, because bad liars just say yes or no. They don't, you know, explain the lie. But so in that sense, being a great liar and a great reader, it was sort of natural. But it took until I was 22 and I was in a, had to drop my human anatomy class, and the only class that fit the schedule was a poetry writing workshop. And I took it. I always liked poetry. And I always liked it mostly because, you know, in high school, girls liked it, and and then, you know, showing interest in something. It works. That's the thing I tell young men now. It works. I'm going to tell you a story of why poetry works. When I met my wife, she was involved with this really tall, very handsome, you know, antelope chasing Indian man. And you know, and I knew him, you know, and I thought, oh, great, this guy, you know, this is like, you know, cheekbones like this, you know. I mean, knock people over when he's turned his head from side to side, you know. And I thought, how can I compete with that, you know? I mean, I look fine, but I'm a geek, you know, I really am. And I thought, oh, great, what am I going to do? How am I going to compete with this? So I wrote her poems. And the other guy didn't read. I mean, he lives here. He might be in the room. I don't know. But I'm using you. And, you know, I mean, there's nothing better than being a poet competing romantically against a poetic illiterate. And I won. you know, so I right away recognized the power of poetry. And, but, you know, seriously, I picked up this anthology called Songs on This Earth on Turtle's Back, which was an anthology of contemporary Indian poetry, and I love the stuff in there. There's poems about powwows and fry bread and 49s, and I saw myself in literature for the first time, and particularly a line of poetry by this poet named Adrian Lewis, who had this line that says, "Oh, Uncle Adrian, I'm in the reservation of my mind." Oh. For me, that line had the same kind of power that John Steinbeck's ending of Grapes of Wrath did, with the, you know, the starving man being suckled by the woman. And it had the same exact kind of power, and even more so because I saw myself for the first time, and I thought, I can do this, and I want to do this, and it's all I've thought about since.
I have the impression from the clips I've read that you also write songs. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was sort of an accident, actually, again. Yeah. Jim Boyd, who's a Colville Indian musician I work with, writes songs with. He and I performed together a few years ago at the Columbia Folk Music Festival. They invited me to come in and read poems. And he's been a local hero for a long time. For those of you who are familiar with Indian music, he was a guitarist in Exit. Indians would know the band. Oh, great eagle, king of the sky. So he was a hero. He was the guy who played an Exit. But he had released independently some stuff, and so he was a hero to me. And we started talking, and we started working together a little bit. And as I was writing Reservation Blues, a novel about an all-Indian Catholic rock and roll band, I was writing lyrics. And Jim liked them. We made songs together and independently released a CD, you know, Reservation Blues, the soundtrack. It's actually pretty good. Good enough to where the Indigo Girls heard it through friends. They got a copy of it. They liked it, and they were doing a benefit CD called Honor to benefit the Honor of the Earth Fund, and put us on it, one of our songs. We got to do shows with them this last fall in New York with the Indigo Girls, Jane Seabury, in Minneapolis with Bruce Coburn and the Indigo Girls, and here in L.A. with Bonnie Raitt, Toad the Wet Sprocket, and... the Indigo Girls, and it was great. In Minneapolis, I got to stand up in front of 5,000 people and read a poem. I mean, nobody gets to do that in this country, nobody. And it being an Indigo Girls crowd, there are 4,700 lesbians. And I've always had this thing for inaccessible women, you know. And, so I was in heaven, you know. I mean, I was like, tonight I'm a lesbian, and you're all Indians. And, so they were into that. But so it was great, and the Indigo girls were really nice, and everybody was very friendly and very honorable, and all the, you know, big name artists working with a lot of other Indian music artists, Eulalie, John Trudell, you know, many others who are on the CD, and so, you know, for it's a big con for me because I can't sing, I can't play an instrument, but I got to, you know, be on the same stage with Bonnie Raitt.
You know, this may be the question you've heard most often in your touring. By the way, I happen to know from our chat before we started that Sherman has done 44 cities as a touring author, which is really, it has to be some kind of record. And I'll bet you've been asked this question a lot, but I can't help, I can't resist asking it. You reject the term Native American, you commented on it in your remarks, and prefer the term Indian. Can you explain why it's so offensive to you, or so off-putting to you?
Well, it's not offensive. I mean, one is just as inaccurate as the other. And if you're born here, you're a Native American. That would include most of everybody in this room, I assume. But the Indian, that's who we are. I don't know how to explain it. Indian. I don't know. I mean, in some ways, I suppose it's sort of like Joy Harjo has an anthology of Indian literature coming out, Indian women's literature, and it's called Reinventing the Enemy's Language. Mm-hmm. So by taking that term, Indian, which is so inaccurate, and making it our own, we sort of take the power away from it. And I suppose that's what we've done. Mm-hmm. And Native American is, I mean, excuse me, it's just an invention of guilty white liberals.
Well, let's talk about guilty white liberals a little bit. Being one myself.
I'm part guilty white liberal. My grandfather was a guilty white liberal.
Okay. Well, you gotta love us, right? I mean, maybe not. You told the Village Voice, I think liberals cause much more damage to Indian culture and people than conservatives do. And can you explain why you feel that way? And what damage are you talking about?
Well, I doubt there's a conservative running around out there pretending to be Indian. Mm-hmm. I doubt there's a conservative out there who is adopting Indian cultures and religious practices. I doubt there are a whole lot of Republicans in sweat lodges. And I mean, the final stage of any colonial process is the subjugation and total adoption of the colonized culture, their religious mm-hmm. expression. That's throughout history, throughout the history of human beings, the last stage in the colonial process to eliminate the colonized, you totally adopt their culture. And the people participating in that final stage of colonization in this country are white liberals who, in their misguided notions to help, thinking they're helping us and helping themselves, they're actually contributing to, you know, the continued genocide of Indians in this country. And that's what I meant by that comment.
Okay, let me push if I could, from a cultural perspective to a political perspective, and using liberal to define a political agenda, would you say the same thing applies? Do you think that liberal politics in America is more threatening to Indian people and Indian culture than conservative politics?
No. Okay. But it hasn't made a lot of difference, though, who's in power for Indians. It really hasn't. I mean, ironically, the very best president for Indians was Richard Nixon. In terms of, you know, autonomy and sovereign rights and these programs he established, I mean, that's the worst thing. You think about all this pain and horrible stuff and terrible things this country has done to us. The very worst is the fact that we Indians, when asked who was the best president, we have to say Richard Nixon. I mean, that's sort of like the final straw. I mean, damn you all. But I think overall it's conservative politics that do a lot more damage to everybody mm-hmm. than liberal politics. Although I think one of the real failures of liberalism is that it has no sense of humor. Conservatives are winning because they're funny. Rush Limbaugh is so successful because he's damn funny. And I think we need to have liberals with a sense of humor. Either that or we need to start liberal militias. I mean, my friend Scott and I, who's gay, we've decided to start a liberal militia that only includes Indians and gay men, or gay Indian men. And you know, we're going to be called the Children of the Burning Bush. And we're going to be the best dressed militia in the country. And the skinniest. Our camouflage pants are going to be tucked into our boots just right. But you know, I'm not advocating violence, just the idea of violence. I mean, the reason liberal politicians compromise so much is that they're afraid of being shot. Because, I mean, it's not liberals who are carrying the guns. It's right-wing people who have the guns. And liberal politician, that's something to worry. I mean, think throughout history, this century especially, any leftist politician who has radically changed and radically challenged the status quo has been assassinated, all of them. Without exception, all of them, whether being shot, imprisoned, all of them. There's not one that has not been assassinated, co-opted, or disappeared, or imprisoned. So, I mean, we need to start fighting back. I mean, somebody needs to, like, you know, I'm a pacifist myself, but I wouldn't mind it if. I can think of, you know, situations where certain politicians might be threatened. And through those threats, they might actually have to compromise a little bit. Bring, I don't want to name names because people listen.
I came across a comment you made, and I would like to quote it back to you. I am a colonized person living in a colonial country. That's my relationship with the United States. The analogy I give to white people is, imagine being dropped into the middle of Compton, California, at midnight on a Friday. That's exactly how I feel living in the United States when I'm not on my reservation. And the question I have for you is, do you still feel that way? Do you feel an alienation and estrangement when you're off the reservation and in the places that you've been on in visiting 44 cities to talk about your work?
Well, you know, yeah, I do. I mean, but it's interesting. One of the things that has changed, you know, I grew up in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, the most homogenous part of the country. I mean, Spokane itself is 97% white. Seattle's, despite its image as this multicultural mecca, is about 85% white. And, you know, multiculturalism in Seattle generally means what kind of clothes you choose to wear. So that's the environment I grew up in. So, you know, obviously I was always aware of differences. And it's interesting, though, that as I've started traveling more, and especially back east, where it's much more, you know, down here in the Southwest and in LA, where it's much more racially mixed, where I could be anything. I mean, in New York, I can be Italian, I can be Jewish, I can be Middle Eastern, you know, Indian, Chinese, Japanese, I've been mistaken for everything. I don't like it. I don't like being down here, somebody come up to me and hola, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, Indios, you know, but, you know, bow and arrow, red Indian, but, and it's not that I have a problem with those groups. It's just that I have a very firm grasp on my self-identity, and anything that challenges that, I'm not used to, especially outside of the Pacific Northwest, where I'm unmistakably what I am. Mm-hmm. You'd be dark in Seattle. That's the relationship I have. And I mean, the key point here is that the United States is a colony still. We are no different than South Africa, and I don't know why people want to deny that. At what point does South Africa stop being a colony? Would any of you say that it's going to stop being a colony ever? No, mm-hmm. It's not going to be, and the United States is never going to stop being a colony. I mean, you are all, apart from the indigenous people of this country, the rest of you are colonials, And you don't like to hear that. I mean, this whole manifest destiny thing is really infused in the national character here. Even in the most progressive liberal in this country, they're still wrapped up in that somehow they belong here. They were supposed to be here. I mean, they invent scientific theories. The Bering Strait land bridge theory to justify, say, well, you came here too. You know, you weren't from here. You walked over the bridge from Asia, in 90 below degree weather over, mountains twice the size of the Cascades, with no food, no animals there. You walked thousands and thousands of miles. You climbed mountains without any gear, wearing fur, having no shoes. You walked through huge chasms of ice and earthquakes and rumblings and the ice flow stretching across Canada and Alaska, and you made it here. Sure we did. I mean, it's always amazing. Watch the news, I mean, people somehow think science is apart from politics. Science is just as political as politics are. And every time there's evidence found here of life that predates Asian life, all of a sudden, a week later, scientists, oh no, we found this pot in Taiwan that's older than this. And then the next year they find one in Brazil that's older than that, and then a couple weeks later, no, we have this one, we have this, watch, it happens, watch, every time. Watch the next big scientific discovery of life in this part of the world, in the Americas, that predates Asian life. Very rapidly after that, they find something else to predate that. Yeah. So, the entire country's science, economics, philosophies, politics, sociology is based on the fact of justifying the colonial presence here.
You know, I have been reading a book called The Birth of the Modern by Paul Johnson. It's a history, world history set in the 1830s. And one of the things I learned, which I did not know, was that Andrew Jackson conducted a genocidal war against the Indians of the Southeast, and that it was his war aim in 1812, War of 1812, to drive Indians out of the Southeast, and succeeded in it. And what it reminds me of is how little we hear of the genocidal quality of American history in its treatment of Indians. It's not just race discrimination, it's not just colonization, it's actual extermination. I'm wondering if, and you touched on that earlier, but I'm wondering, oh dear, sorry. Oops. I'm wondering if you feel some responsibility to make that point when addressing non-Indian audiences, that the Indian experience has not just been one of discrimination, but of an attempt to exterminate.
They get mad at me. Painful reminders of the truth, I guess. It's one of the things I do. It's part of the national consciousness against to deny, this huge, massive state of denial about what happened here. I've talked with many people about why nobody calls what happened here a Holocaust, mm-hmm. when it is the same thing. All the parallels are the same between, let's say, the Nazi Holocaust.
Sure.
Everything is exactly the same. And in fact, one life is too many anywhere, but in terms of scale, the percentage of tribes and Indian peoples murdered and slaughtered and disappeared here dwarfs the Nazi Holocaust. And I can't think of why. Everywhere else in the world, I'll tell you this, every other country in the world is vitally aware of what happened here. When I go overseas on book tours, they want to talk about it. Why doesn't the United States admit what happened there? Spain, Italy, France, they're into it. They're like, that country you live in. And I'm going, yeah, that country I live in. But, and I think part of it is, frankly, first and foremost, there were no motion pictures. Very little photographs. Mm-hmm. I think if you would have seen more photographs, moving images of mass graves, of children and women torn to pieces, mm-hmm. In this country, it might make a difference. And secondly, we fought back. Mm-hmm. We didn't hide. We didn't run. We stood up and fought back. Mm-hmm. That's not to diminish or insult the Jewish people during World War II. I mean, I would have hid too. I would have looked for the nearest closet, and you know. Here we fought back, and I think that's why we have not been forgiven, yeah. And that's why we the Holocaust that happened here has not been honestly talked about. And you know, that's a crime.
You know, the thought occurred to me, we talk a lot among ourselves and in the media about the politics of race in the United States, and especially in this community, in Southern California, it has been placed in high relief by the O.J. Simpson trial and by the Rodney King beating, and yet it always seems to be defined as an issue of black and white, which is ironic in the extreme in Southern California when there are Hispanic and Asian people in equal numbers or greater numbers than other so-called minorities. But off the charts, you know, kind of not a blip on the radar, is the question of Indians. Do you feel that people and the culture and the media overlook the fact that there is a political element that focuses on American Indians in public debate, that that's simply ignored?
Well, first of all, I want to make a comment about that Hispanic term. I don't like that. I mean, I keep wondering where Hispania is. I mean, I hate that term.
What do you prefer?
And I hate when people call. I was at a Sonics game a few weeks ago, and this guy walked. One guy was obviously Indian, American Indian, and the other guy I thought might have been Indian. I said, "You guys Indian?" He goes, "Well, he's Indian. I'm Hispanic." And I got so mad at him. I thought, oh, really? Where in Hispania are you from?
Now, what do you prefer? That's the question. What name do you prefer?
Mexican. Okay. You know, whatever country you're from, Hispania. Anyways, we really get left out a lot of discussion, mostly because we don't have much political social power because of our small population. But through the casinos, we're rising in political power because politics in this country is about money, and those who have money have power, and we're getting more and more money, therefore more political power. And like in Washington State that I mentioned, they're trying to prevent us from contributing to political campaigns, and they're afraid of us because when we have more money, we can hire better lawyers. And when we hire better lawyers, we'll get more of our treaties honored. And when we get more of our treaties honored, that means more of you are going to have to move. That's frightening to people. And they're going to take it away. They're going to take the casinos away. It's simply, many are going to fail because we have too many of them. But they're going to take them away. And the arguments about the morality of gambling, I mean, give me a break. Capitalism is dependent on the immorality and the exploitation of vices. That's all capitalism is, mm-hmm. And so we're participating in it. I mean, you know, you wanted us to assimilate, to become fully functioning members of society, and we are, and we're winning, and that gets people mad. And plus, you know, they talk about the mafia influence. The mafia is going to come in and take over. Well, fine. I mean, you think we really could tell the difference between the mafia and the United States government? I mean, if the mafia comes in, and I'm not saying they have or haven't, I mean, the United States government's not going to mess with us. I mean,
plus they're experts at casino industry.
Yeah, we're going to be better run, better organized, and have better pasta. Yeah. And there's always been this, I mean, I think there really is this, you know, inherent mafia-Indian connection. I mean, you look at the mafia, you ever see Goodfellas? I mean, you hear, in mafia movies, think of their names. They got guys named Twitchy and Double Joe and Sleepy and stuff. And Indians do the same thing. I mean, every nickname that was in Goodfellas, there's a guy in my reservation with the same nickname.
Before I bring our conversation to end, I want to give the audience another chance. Go ahead.
Do you see the success of your work opening doors for other younger Indian writers?
Let me repeat the question. Do you see the success of your writing as opening doors for other Indian writers?
Indirectly and directly. Indirectly in the sense that I'm selling copies. and making publishers think that there's an economic positive when dealing with Indian writers. So I think some people are getting published in that way. In fact, it was interesting after Fancy Dancing came out, The Business of Fancy Dancing, my first book, a book that contained stories and poems together in a package. The year after that, there are like 6 or 7 books by Indians that contain stories and poems. So I think they saw how that worked, and they were trying to model themselves after that. And the books were good, and it really helped. Indirectly, I mean, directly, I've gotten people published. I get their work to agents and to publishers. And when publishers call me and ask me, you know, who should we be looking at, I've gotten Indians public speaking gigs. I get called, I could literally, speak at universities and conferences 365 days a year. I'd be on the road all year long. And so they call me and, they want an Indian. And I can't go, so they said, what other Indian should we get? I'm sort of the Indian clearinghouse. So that way, I get to help a lot of people. I think many of the Indian writers before me weren't so directly active in that sort of helping mode. They indirectly helped by their books, but I think a lot of other Indian writers of previous generations are very isolated in that sense, due in large part to the fact is that they were trailblazing. Mm-hmm. They were doing something nobody had done before, and I have the benefit of their experience and the benefit of their wisdom to be able to help the next generation of Indian writers.
Great.
John? I teach in a middle school, a rural school next to a Paiute Shoshone reservation, and a quarter of the population are Indian kids. What should I tell them tomorrow? What would you like me to tell them?
The question is,
do you have a message? Or?
The question is, what message would you encourage this gentleman to give to his students who are Indians?
The message I would give to them, as I give to everybody everywhere, read books. Books will save your life. That's the only sure thing in the world. There's nothing else you can depend on. Not another person, not an animal, not an emotion, nothing. But you can depend on a book. And the more books you read, the better you're going to do in anything you choose to do. And that's what I would tell them, books. Books, 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 books.
Are you going to write a book for middle school kids someday? I don't think I'd want them to read Indian children.
Oh. The question is, are you going to write books that would be aimed for a middle school audience?
Well, actually, Lone Ranger and Tonto was on the American Library Association recommended list. I've gotten letters from, quite a few dozen high school teachers and high school kids across the country where it's being taught. Indian Killer, I don't necessarily think I would recommend to a high school crowd. Well, yeah, I would. It's nothing they don't see on TV or at home every day. But I'm working on some ideas and books for young people, for not only young readers, middle readers, young adult. And the real impetus I know is going to be having a child myself. The worst crime against Indian people is in children's literature. Oh, God, that crap is awful. Ah, jeez, just terrible corn pollen, eagle feather, father, mother, scum. Oh, and you think, very few books written for young people that contain any kind of realistic images of Indians. I want to write a children's book about Indians that contains, like an Indian working as a doctor or a plumber, a carpenter. In all Indian literature, there's a real absence of Indians with jobs. It's quite amazing. And another thing I've noticed, too, and this is our fault, Indians don't have sex, according to literature. And actually, culturally, we're probably the horniest people on the planet. casual sex is something of a ceremony for us, but we don't write about it, so I'm working on that now. I'm putting lots of sex scenes, I'm trying to stay away from, stereotypical images, too. I don't want, some guy's tomahawk or something, or fingers fancy dancing across brown skin or something.
We had a question here.
I had a question. You mentioned you have a very strong self-identity, and it's very
wondering what specifically, what you went through to gain such a positive image of yourself. I would say, this is speaking from outside of the Indian race, because I've never been in India, but I would say one of the hard things would be to kind of understand where you fit in, when you have all these false images of who you're supposed to be, what people tell you you're supposed to be, you know, like Father Sky and all that kind of stuff. I'm trying to figure out where you fit in the country that you're living in. How did you get to where you were?
The question is, how did you achieve a positive image of yourself and fit into the to the culture that you come from?
Oh. A lot of hard work. Therapy. Writing. Big thing. Big thing. Falling in love with an Indian woman. Get in trouble here again. Well, I'll tell a story. At an awards ceremony in the not too distant past, somewhere in the country, in the Native American awards ceremony, the theme of the evening, whether planned or not planned, became about how Indian men had really become these new warriors and were doing these great things for Indian people, really changing things, really doing positive things. So, you know, the Indian men in the crowd were getting stroked all night long. You know, you're this, you're that, you're wonderful, you're crazy horse come back, on and on and on. And toward the end of the evening, this Indian elder woman, this grandmother, got up to the podium and she said, and for those of you who know Indian grandmothers, this is, you know, this is completely on par. She got up and said, you know, I keep hearing all you people talk about how great these Indian men are, how much positive things they're doing for all Indian people and their tribes and stuff, you know, but as I look out in the crowd, you know, I notice all you really, really successful Indian men have blondes on your arms. And I'm really wondering, what am I supposed to tell my granddaughter, you know, my Indian granddaughter? What am I supposed to tell her when the very best men we have, you know, are with white women? You know, and I heard that story and I thought, yeah, what is she supposed to tell her? That these men we hold up, that these men we call our ideals, that these men we call our leaders and our heroes, are not choosing to spend their lives with the women who raised them. You know, and I'm not against interracial relationships, you know, not at all. I mean, I celebrate love wherever it's found. I have family, you who are mixed, you know, I have blonde nieces and nephews who I love very much, but for me, it was a very personal decision to find, I specifically was going to find an Indian woman. And that had a lot to do. That has a lot to do with my positive self-image, the way I feel about myself. I'm very, very proud of my decision. And I know, you know, 99% of Indian women out there are very, very proud of me as well. I mean, I was down here a few years ago when I was dating Diane, and I gave a reading at UCLA, and the Indian women cornered me. The Indian students there cornered me. So, who are you dating? I said, she's Hadatsa. She really Hadatsa? Want to see a picture? And so that was a very conscious decision you know, that has a lot to do with my pride, my self-identity. You know, it's not that she gave me my self-identity. Of course not. But certainly, I did something very tribal. Even though she's not a member of my tribe, I did something very tribal. And when I go out to help Indian people, I do a lot of workshops for Indian kids, a lot of, you know, writing workshops. I visit a lot of Indian schools and reservations and urban Indian communities. You know, I donate time and money. I'm on the Board of Trustees of the American Indian College Fund. So my self-pride comes not necessarily from feeling better about myself, but it comes from helping to make other Indians feel better about themselves. And so I become a better Indian and feel better about my identity and have a stronger self-identity simply by being more and more tribal. And it makes sense. I mean, that's how we were set up. That's in our genetics. That's how our tribes were. Everybody had a role. And what they did in that tribe helped the whole tribe, whether it was hunting or warrior, stealing horses or cooking or taking care of the kids. Everybody had a role that was just as important as every other role. And my role is to tell stories. 200 years ago, I would have been sitting around a fire on the Spokane River. People would have gave me salmon for a story. I said, here, I have another one. I would have told the story. And now I make a few dollars. But it's the same thing. And I've come to realize that. It's really recognizing how I can use my skills to be more tribal. And that's why I feel better about myself.
Thank you. I think we have time for perhaps one more question before we close the proceedings. So
go ahead. Just briefly to summarize, the question is about the implication of being less than full-blooded Indian and the other...
And mostly about disunity among Indian people of different blood quanta, I guess is really...
And the question of disunity among Indians of different blood quanta.
Well, being Indian is about a lot more than just blood quantum. It's political, cultural, social, etc. I mean, there are full-blood Indians out there who I think are terrible, who I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't cross the street to visit with, who I think have co-opted and been so detrimental and terrible to Indian people, I wouldn't, you know, rather, you know, well, anyway, you know what I mean. For instance, Russell Means is a full-blood Sioux. But, I mean, Pocahontas' father in a cartoon. I mean, is that the state of our political life where one of our, you know, revolutionary leaders plays the voice of a cartoon Indian? That's terrible. That's terrible. They've dedicated their lives and lived their lives among us, and they're wonderful. And you know, some teachers, some other people have come to work there, and these people show up with their, you know, talking like white people, and then 6 months later they're sitting around having their worst res accents in the place, you know, and they're wonderful, but all too often the real problem is people who claim Indian blood or researching their backgrounds. It's not about, well, I'm finding out about my background so I can help Indian people. It's always an individual decision. It's, you know, I'm rewarding myself. I'm going to get into myself. I'm discovering more about myself, my spirituality. It's how is being Indian going to benefit me? You know, whether spiritually or economically. I mean, two great jobs in this state, jobs set aside at universities in Indian studies departments were given to people who've become Indian in the last decade. Now, that pisses me off. I mean, that's the problem with affirmative action programs. That's one of the problems. I mean, people who, you know, who don't deserve these positions are getting them and therefore make affirmative action and those kind of quotas look bad. You know, and that's the thing that angers me, is when people are using their Indian ancestry to benefit themselves and to benefit themselves at the expense of Indian people. You know, nothing gets me madder than somebody who says, well, like that Embraced by the Light woman, Edel, or whatever her name is. I guess she was raised on a res, and she has some Indian blood. Talk about exploiting spirituality. Talk about taking advantage of people. I mean, if any of you bought that book and bought into that, I feel really sorry for you. I mean, you really need to do some soul searching if you're going to allow a book like that to become sort of Bible for you. You see the cover of the sequel where she's in her Indian costume on the cover? Like, oh, you pathetic thing, you. You're not going to find spiritual life in any book, not even the Bible. Just a guide. And that really bothers me when people use images like that to benefit economically. I was always taught that the second a dollar bill is involved in any transaction, the spiritual value of that interaction is immediately invalidated. You cannot buy us or buy your way into heaven. You know, that's pretty fundamental. And a lot of us are trying to do it. And a lot of pseudo-Indians or people who have Indian blood are taking advantage of the general spiritual drought in this country. I have a problem with people with Indian blood taking advantage of people economically and spiritually. You're either Indian or you're not. And it has nothing to do with blood quantum. And the second I hear somebody describe themselves as mixed blood, I get suspicious. We're all mixed blood. I have the blood of 5 tribes in me. But, I'm not mixed blood. I am Spokane Indian. And if you don't understand that concept, then I'm suspicious of you. And I think most Indians would be suspicious of you. I mean, the second somebody comes up to me and says, I'm part Cherokee, I'm part Choctaw, I'm part Apache, I go, then I know that, they're not Indian. Or I assume they're not Indian, because no Indian introduces themselves that way. Ever. Ever. We have, being Indian is a very exclusive club. And it's an exclusive club because there are so few of us. At one point we might have had the luxury of allowing a lot of people in and not caring. But we're fighting for our survival. We're panda bears. And honestly, I would rather us die out and cease to exist than continue to be culturally and genetically dissipated like we are being. California being a prime example. Have you ever been to a powwow in California? It's very sad. It's a fatalist view and cynical view, I suppose, and negative view. But I just know the pain that people go through. I mean, I went through that same pain myself of trying to identify with being Indian, trying to be proud of who I am. And I understand the feeling that people wanting to be Indian, it's a beautiful culture, it's a beautiful history. And if you want to join in, great. Regardless of your blood levels, great. But understand, you're going to get questioned. People are going to be suspicious of you. People are going to question your motives. People are not going to like you. I get questioned all the time. Are you really Indian? I mean, there's rumors going around I didn't grow up on a res, that I'm not Indian. Start laughing. Well, You know, I'm much too vilified on my res not to have grown up there. But you know, I mean, you have to understand that we've gone through a terrible history. I mean, this country divided us on purpose, and we didn't get along before you showed up anyways. So nothing has changed. I mean, if you want to join the club, grab an oar. But don't, you know, whine. Don't complain about, oh, nobody loves me, nobody recognizes me. Oh, I have this past, I feel it in my bones. I'm Indian in my bones, and I want to get in the sweat lodge. And I mean, first of all, start being accurate. There are very few sweat lodge tribes in the country. Very few. So quit being inappropriate, you know. And, I mean, if you want to do it properly. First and foremost, don't go into a sweat lodge with some white guy who says he's a shaman. Don't buy those damn stupid books. Indians, too, you guys are buying them, too, you clueless urbans. And be politically active. I mean, you know, support, and please, please, let the Leonard Peltier thing go. God. I mean, I feel the same way about him these days that I feel about O.J. They framed a guilty man. I mean, let's not make a martyr out of somebody who doesn't deserve martyrdom. I mean, I don't respect anybody who ever carried a gun. I mean, you know, let's not have the Free Leonard Peltier Defense Fund. Let's have the Educate Indian Children Defense Fund. You know, all the millions of dollars all you Indians and white people are, you know, contribute all the time you're contributing to free one man can be better used elsewhere. I mean, he's become an inappropriate symbol. I mean, and while he should not be in jail because he did not commit the crimes he's in jail for, I mean, let's move on. And you know, let's get him out, but please, I mean, let's worry about other things as well. And now I'm just angry and babbling now. But you know, when my phone rings at 3 a.m, I'm terrified. Because for many, many years now, my whole life, when the phone rang at 3 a.m, it meant that one of my cousins, one of my friends, somebody on some reservation I knew, somebody in the city I knew, died. You know, I've been at probably over 50 wakes and funerals in my short life. Our pain is the only thing we have left. I mean, let us at least have that.
Thank you. It's my responsibility to bring this portion of the program to an end. Sherman Alexie will be signing outside the auditorium in a few minutes. On behalf of everyone here, thank you for sharing with us a very memorable and very meaningful afternoon. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.